This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Mark Whitaker. He has written a compelling biography about Bill Cosby, his life and times, one of the most enduring and successful entertainers in the history of this country. It all began for Cosby in Philadelphia, and he, of course, was not born with a silver spoon. We'll talk with Mark Whitaker about Cosby's impact on comedy and our culture. Also, Rufus Craig, remember that name? He finished second to Bill Cassidy in the 2012 race for the U.S. House in the 6th District. Then nobody was lining up to run except for Cassidy or Craig and one other candidate against Cassidy, and now there are 12 people challenging Edwin Edwards in that race. We'll talk with Rufus Craig. And we'll revisit LSU's debacle against Mississippi State. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Tomorrow, our guest for much of the hour is going to be Senator Mary Landrieu, live and in studio. So should be a compelling conversation with Senator Landrieu exactly 6 weeks before her election, in which she is being challenged by two strong Republicans in Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus. We begin today with Mark Whitaker, the author of the critically acclaimed memoir, My Long Trip Home. He's the former managing editor of CNN, previously was Washington bureau chief for NBC News and a reporter and editor at Newsweek. There he rose to become the first African-American leader of a national news weekly. He has written a compelling biography about one of the great entertainers of this time or any other, Cosby, His Life and Times, from Mark Whitaker. Mark is a product of Philadelphia, as is Bill Cosby. Good morning, Mark Whitaker.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. Well, you were born when Cosby was about 20 years old, and it was about that time that he started making his move toward the icon that he is today. And it was a move with some twists and turns. It did not come easy for him.
It did not. He was born in North Philadelphia. In the age of largely segregated community there. And he grew up in a housing project in North Philadelphia called the Richard Allen Homes. His father was a very troubled man, a drinker, basically abandoned the family when Cosby was quite young and joined the Navy and was largely absent for most of his childhood. And his mother, who was a wonderful woman, and you know, really, you know, did her best to instill her belief in education to young Bill, worked as a maid, and you know, 12-14 hour days. So she wasn't around much either. You know, he was a bright student. He was tested in the fifth grade as having the highest IQ in his grade. You know, he couldn't focus on his schoolwork. He ended up flunking the 10th grade twice, dropping out of high school, joining the Navy, where he really, for the first time, developed some discipline and some focus, decided he wanted to go to college, but his SAT scores were so bad, a combined SAT score of 500, that he only got in because the track coach took pity on him and got him in on a track scholarship. So up to that point in his life, in his mid-20s, when he first starts doing stand-up, nothing really has worked for him. And so it's really miraculous from that background that he became the success that that he did.
And when his career began to take an upward turn in the early 1960s, we were in the midst of Vietnam and the Kennedy assassination and the civil rights movement. People like Dick Gregory were popular then, who had a much different style than Bill Cosby. And Cosby was criticized for not talking more about the issues of the day. How did he make this meteoric rise?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He's known, of course, for having a very universal, non-racial style of comedy, but he didn't start out that way. While he was at Temple, he started performing first in little clubs in Philadelphia. And then after the summer between his sophomore and junior year, he decides to go to Greenwich Village in New York to try his hand at performing there. And when he first arrives, he's doing a lot of racial humor. In fact, he's modeling himself after Dick Gregory. And the New York Times does a feature piece about him in which he brags about being the young Dick Gregory. And the piece talks about all the racial barbs in his act. But when he saw that piece in print, he got very upset because it made him realize that, one, he didn't want to be just like Dick Gregory. You know, Cosby was always a huge fan of jazz and, in fact, wanted to be a jazz drummer at one point. I think had he been good at enough at it, he probably would have done that instead of become a comedian. But one of the things he took from jazz was you have to have your own style. And so he resolved at that point to develop his own style, to wean himself from the race-based humor, to develop a style of comedy that was really sort of unique in that it didn't involve telling jokes, but really telling stories and making them funny. And then the other thing which he did, which was quite unusual at the time, is that he decided that his act was going to be clean. You know, and this was the age of Lenny Bruce and, you know, a lot of other, you know, comedy that included a lot of profanity. And it's not that Cosby was a stranger to profanity. After all, he had been in the Navy and grown up on the streets of North Philadelphia. But he thought that for many comedians, it was a crutch and that, you know, it was easy to get people to laugh by using a lot of blue humor, and that he would have a much better sense of whether his comedy was actually working if he left profanity out of it. So it's really at that point that he starts developing the style of comedy that that he became famous for.
And he was one of those in that time. He had great success with record albums of his work. That's something
that's right,
lost
and it was
treasure.
Sort of exactly, and you know, probably for some of your younger listeners, they may not even remember the golden age of record albums. But one of the, you know, I call my book Cosby, His Life and Times, and it's his life story. But it's also there's a backdrop of a lot of history over the you know, now 77 years of his life. A lot of it is social history and racial history, but there's also the history of technology and how different technologies change the world of entertainment. So Cosby comes along just as America is embracing not just records, but these long-playing albums with anywhere from 25 to 30 minutes per side. And it is an ideal format for the kind of humor, the kind of storytelling humor that Cosby is developing. And after his success in the Village, performing in these little comedy clubs, gets him his first booking on The Tonight Show in August of 1963. And as a result of that performance, he very quickly gets a record contract with Warner Brothers Records, which leads to a string of phenomenally successful comedy albums. Mm-hmm. The first one is Bill Cosby is a Very Funny Fellow, Right? I mean, people of my generation can remember the names of all of these albums. I Started Out as a Child, Why Is There Air, Wonderfulness, Revenge, and To My Brother Russell, mm-hmm. whom I slept with. And with each album, his stories get longer and longer. So by the time you get to the last one, To Russell, My Brother, the routine about sleeping in the same bed with his younger brother, Russell, growing up, is the entire 25-minute B-side of that album. So, and when you think about it, you know, people, it was only the technology of these long playing albums that made it possible for, first of all, for Cosby to stretch those stories out as long as they did, and for people to really sort of appreciate that. So he was, he would go on to be a pioneer in so many other areas, but he really revolutionized the use of LPs with those long stories.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Our guest is Mark Whitaker, who's had quite a career in the media himself. And like Bill Cosby, he is from the city of brotherly love, and he has written perhaps the most definitive book about Bill Cosby to date, Cosby, His Life and Times. Bill Cosby is 77 years old, and he has been on the national scene now for more than a half century. Now, along the time that these comedy albums were taking root in the culture, along comes I Spy. That made him famous in a different realm.
That's right. What happened was a producer named Sheldon Leonard, who at the time was the most successful comedy producer of the era, along with his partner Danny Thomas, who some of your listeners probably remember. Mm-hmm. They were the producers of The Andy Griffith Show, Dick Van Dyke. He had an idea for a drama that would be, you know, in those days, everybody was sort of, the James Bond films had just become popular. And all these TV producers were trying to produce and create shows sort of in that vein, and that leads to The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Get Smart and so forth. Sheldon Leonard's idea was a show with a spy team who would work for the U.S. government, going around the world, masquerading as tennis players, and one would be white and one would be black. He found in Robert Culp, an experienced TV actor, his white star, but then he was looking around who could play the African-American partner. And he discovered Bill Cosby. Actually, it's an interesting story in the book. The person who turned him on to Bill Cosby was Carl Reiner, who at the time was starring in but also directing and the head writer for the Dick Van Dyke Show. He had essentially, mm-hmm. that was his baby, the Dick Van Dyke Show. And his son, who went on to become the very successful actor and director, Rob Reiner, was still in his teens, and he had seen Bill Cosby on The Tonight Show doing his famous Noah routine. And he got so excited, his parents were out for the evening, he stayed up until they came home and acted out the entire routine for them. And when Reiner found out more about Cosby, he thought, well, maybe this is the guy that Sheldon may be looking for his new spy drama. Sheldon Leonard arranged to meet with Bill Cosby, was very impressed, went to see his, he was performing at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco, and decided to cast him. So far so good, except that Cosby had no acting experience. So when they go to shoot the pilot, and the other thing that was revolutionary about I Spy was that Sheldon Leonard had this idea of doing more on-location shooting around the world than had ever been done in any TV show. In the first place, he took the show was Hong Kong, and he shoots a pilot episode in Hong Kong, and Cosby's acting is so bad that the network executives say, we've got to get rid of this guy. And it was only because Sheldon Leonard stood up for him, and also because Robert Culp, who by that time they had become very good friends, decided to take it upon himself to write a half dozen episodes that would allow Cosby to sort of show that he could be an actor, that he held on, and ultimately he won three consecutive Emmys for acting for that show.
297-5633. We'll take some inquiries for Mark Whitaker on his book, Cosby, His Life and Times, from Simon & Schuster, back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Mark Whitaker. His book, Cosby, His Life and Times, from Simon & Schuster. In the book, which is a comprehensive biography of William Henry Cosby, Jr., it comes in conjunction with the 30th anniversary of the show which made Cosby a multimillionaire and made him famous in places he had not been, The Cosby Show. That show, of course, is one that will stand the test of time. People will be watching episodes long after you and I are gone, Mark. But Cosby had a lot of other shows with mixed results. I Spy was successful, but not nearly in the way that The Cosby Show, which ran from 84 to 92, was. What was it about that program that made the audience so receptive to him and the cast?
Well, again, I tell the story in the book. It was not at all obvious at the time that that show was going to be a success. First of all, there hadn't really been a really successful situation comedy since the late 70s, in about at least 5 years when it came on. There was not a single sitcom in the top 20. It was the age of primetime soap operas, Dynasty and Dallas and so forth. Cosby had, after I Spy, three consecutive TV shows that had flopped. The producers who had the idea for the show were this young team, Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner, sort of untested at the time. They had had, they were up-and-coming ABC producers who decided to go out on their own. They had had a sitcom with Madeline Kahn that had been canceled after a season. They were running out of money. They had mortgaged their homes to keep going. And so basically they had one more trip to the plate, and they decided to, you know, bet it all on Bill Cosby. When they took a meeting with him at his home out in California in Pacific Palisades, at first he wanted to do a drama. He didn't even want to do a comedy. They talked him into. They had seen his act starting in about the time that he turns 40 in 1977. Cosby's comedy starts to change. You know, he was famous for routines about childhood. All of a sudden, he starts to do material about being middle-aged, about sort of, you know, what happens to you physically as you get older, but then also the frustrations of being a parent. And the previous year, he had come out with his first concert film called Bill Cosby Himself, and about half of that, it's now considered a classic, actually. It failed at the box office, and people only saw it because it was picked up by cable television. But about half of that concert is you know, these hilarious stories about he and his wife and all the trouble they have with their kids. Anyway, so Carsey and Werner basically were saying the show should reflect the point of view on that film and in your routines. They called it the loving war between parents and children, where the authority of the parents is constantly tested, but ultimately they're determined to remain in charge. And so in this meeting at Cosby's house, after convincing him that he should be doing a comedy rather than a drama, Cosby agreed, but then he thought that his character on the show should be a limo driver and that his wife should be a handywoman, either a carpenter or a plumber, who spoke Spanish. He thought it would be funny to have a wife who was handier than the husband and also who could speak Spanish when they were in an argument and the husband wouldn't understand what she was saying. And it took hours and hours over this long dinner until 1 o'clock in the morning with Carsey and Werner arguing, no, it'll be better and funnier if the parents are professionals who consider themselves very intelligent and have, you know, advanced degrees, but still have all these problems with their kids, which is sort of more in line with, you know, Cosby's comedy routines. And it was only after this long dinner when Cosby called his wife, Camille, to brief her on the discussion, she agreed strongly with the producers that that the couple should be, you know, well-educated professionals. And it was as a result of Camille Cosby weighing in that, you know, we ended up with Cliff and Claire Huxtable, obstetrician and lawyer. Hmm. And they threw the show together in just a matter of months. They didn't have time to do a proper pilot. The only production facility that was available in New York City, where Cosby insisted on filming the show, was a broken-down former silent movie studio in Flatbush, Queens. Flatbush, Brooklyn. So, even after the mini-pilot that they shot went over quite well with audiences, Brandon Tartikoff, who was the president of the network, when he did his pitch to advertisers before the season started, basically said at best this show is going to come in number two to Magnum PI, which was the big show on Thursday nights. And as soon as it debuted that first week, it was the most watched show on television. And it went on to be number three its first season. It was number one for five straight seasons after that, the only show besides All in the Family ever to achieve that. It stays on for 8 years. It's the dominant show of the 80s, and not only is it enormously successful in and of itself, but it rescues NBC. NBC was number three among the networks. It lifts it to number one. There are all these other shows after The Cosby Show that become successes on Thursday night, Cheers, Family Ties, mm-hmm. A Different World. And it lays the groundwork for a whole generation of sitcoms basically based around the persona of big stand-up comedians.
All right, we'll take an inquiry or two for Mark Whitaker from listeners. Here's one. How did the death of Cosby's son, Ennis, affect him?
Well, you know, I write about this at length in the book. There's more than has ever been reported anyplace else. You know, it was a tragedy. Ennis Cosby was his only son. He has five children, as, you know, the Huxtables do on The Cosby Show. Even before Ennis was born, Cosby was, you know, in his comedy routines talking about how much he wanted a son. And he was the apple of Cosby's eye. He was a handsome, charming boy. But he had trouble in school, severe trouble with his studies. And eventually, in college, he was diagnosed as dyslexic. And that sort of turned things around for him. And that's actually, if you remember, Cosby then introduces that as a storyline in The Cosby Show. Theo, the son, also discovers that he's dyslexic. Anyway, he then had decided to devote his life to helping kids with learning disabilities. He's pursuing a doctorate in education at Columbia University in New York, and he goes on vacation in the winter of 1997 to Los Angeles to visit a friend. And he's driving a car that belongs to his parents, an expensive convertible, Mercedes convertible, and gets a flat tire on the San Diego freeway, pulls over to an access road. And as he's changing the tire, he's shot dead by someone who, at first I didn't know who it was, but it turned out to be a sort of a Ukrainian immigrant, a sort of thug, basically, troubled delinquent who ended up being convicted of the murder and going to jail for life. I think everybody can agree that one of the worst things that can happen to anybody in their life is to lose a child. And Cosby responds in a couple of ways. One is just by working. And one of the things I was just struck by in getting to know him and studying him is he's an incredible workaholic and always has been. But ever since Ennis's death, he's on the road constantly. So I think part of the way he's dealt with his grief is to just work even harder than ever. But, you know, some parents, if they've lost a child, can't bear to be reminded of them, or at least on a regular basis, because it's too painful. With Cosby, it's the opposite. He has found ways of keeping Ennis with him, or at least the spirit of Ennis, at all times. He decided to bury Ennis on his estate in Massachusetts, so when he goes home, you know, he passes his gravesite. If you see him perform, he is always, today, he is either wearing or has, draped over the chair where he sits as he's performing, sweatshirts that say, "Hello, friend." Now, "Hello, friend" was Ennis's expression. That's how he greeted people. And Cosby, who also is a great art collector, and in fact, there's going to be an exhibit for the first time of the Cosby art collection at the Smithsonian in November, had dozens of likenesses of Ennis commissioned, paintings, busts, that are in rooms in all of his houses. And often he talks to them.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we're short on time, Mark, but the book is exceptional, about the life and times of Bill Cosby. That's the title, Cosby, His Life and Times. Jerry Seinfeld says, "Whenever I think of my life as a comedian, the first name I think of is Bill Cosby. I know certain religions forbid idol worship. If anyone ever told me I had to stop idolizing Bill Cosby, I would say, sorry, but I'm out of this religion. So if you want to join the religion of Cosby, as I did back in 1966, Mark Whitaker's wonderful new book would be our Bible." High praise from a guy who obviously was influenced by Mr. Cosby, or Dr. Cosby. Mark, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely, and I talk about that influence in the book.
Well, thank you, sir, and congratulations. A fine review in yesterday's New York Times of Mark's book about Bill Cosby. Stand-Up Man is the title of the feature, and it is a book that, to this point, is the definitive work about Bill Cosby. Appreciate it, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And we're joined in studio for few moments by the news and sports director of the Louisiana Radio Network, Jeff Palermo, who covers LSU football. And last Saturday night was not a great moment in the life and times of Leslie Edwin Miles. His Tigers went down to defeat to Mississippi State, 34-29, a game that was not as close as the score indicated, although LSU almost pulled it out. Jeff Palermo, what do you think?
Well, you knew they were going to have with all the youth that's on this team, you knew they were going to have a bad game. I guess you just didn't anticipate it happening on Saturday against a team in Mississippi State that they've won 14 games in a row against, a Saturday night in Tiger Stadium. You just don't anticipate an unranked opponent coming into Tiger Stadium and thoroughly outplaying LSU the way they did. But I think a lot of the fears that LSU fans have had going into the game, they were all realized in that contest. LSU's defensive line is mediocre at best. Mississippi State obviously took advantage of that. You have young quarterbacks that are going to struggle, and Anthony Jennings certainly struggled in that game. I guess the biggest, a surprise that continues, a development that continues to occur throughout the season, is that LSU's having trouble running the football, and I don't think anyone would have imagined that. And so if you can't run the football and your quarterbacks are shaky like they were, or at least Anthony Jennings was on Saturday night, that's a recipe for a bad loss, and that's exactly what happened on Saturday.
Well, this week, LSU will have what amounts to a light workout against New Mexico State, but after that, it gets tough. They play at Auburn. They play at Florida. They play later in the season at Texas A&M, and they have Alabama at home. So suddenly, those who were hoping for a national championship contender might be happy to go 8-4.
And that Arkansas game looks really tough, too, now, because Arkansas runs the ball down your throat, and as we saw on Saturday night, and you go back to the first half of the Wisconsin game, LSU has trouble stopping the run. And I don't know how they're going to improve on that. They can't add personnel to their team. They tried all their defensive tackles in that game, and they couldn't They couldn't stop him. So I don't think there's help on the way. And unless they really coach him up well or do something different schematically, I don't know how much better it really is going to get when it comes to stopping opposing teams when it comes to running the football.
The LSU was down in the game to Mississippi State 34-10 late, and then got it to 34-29 and got the ball back and got it on the State 46. And in the final moment of the game, Brandon Harris was throwing in the end zone. And there was an LSU receiver there. If the ball had been tipped, he possibly could have had a bluegrass miracle in front of about 15,000 fans. It would have been amazing. It would have served the fans right for leaving so early.
They started leaving midway through the third quarter. But, you know, you mentioned Brandon Harris's success. You know, here's the other issue that's a deal that's affecting this LSU football team. You have two quarterbacks in Brandon Harris and Anthony Jennings that were comfortable running spread offenses in high school football, and then you bring them into a pro style offense at LSU, and they're struggling with it. Now, a lot of people are going to say, "Hey, Brandon Harris should be the starter." Well, Harris had success because he was running an offense that he was familiar with. If he starts against New Mexico State or starts against Florida in 2 weeks or Auburn, excuse me, in 2 weeks, they're going to go back to that pro-style offense. And you know, that's another thing. They got to really coach these quarterbacks up because they're doing something that they are unfamiliar with, and which takes a lot of time instead of lining up in the shotgun formation with three or four wide receivers. Now you're behind, you're taking snaps from center, and you got two tight ends, and it's a little different.
I think the happiest LSU graduate Saturday night might have been Edwin Washington Edwards, and we're about to segue to the congressional race, but it was on November 16th, 1991, 23 years ago, that State last won in Tiger Stadium, and it was on that night that David Ernest Duke lost to Edwin Edwards 61-39%. Could this be an omen, Jeff Palermo?
It might be. It might be. At least in the primary. I don't know about the runoff.
But State does not win in Tiger Stadium very often and has not beaten LSU at all since 1999 when Jerry DiNardo was the head coach. Jeff came here in 2000. You've never seen State.
In fact, my first game I ever saw in Tiger Stadium was an LSU-Mississippi State game that went into, I think it might have been the first overtime in Death Valley, if I recall correctly. First or second. It was at the time of the new overtime rules, and LSU beat Mississippi State in overtime.
But Dan Mullen has a good team, and LSU, as hard as it is to accept, maybe the worst team in the West right now.
I don't know. We'll see. You know, we've seen Les Miles' teams, you know, have bad performances and they've rebounded. So I don't want to count the hat out, but right now, an 0-3 start in the SEC is possible.
Well, we'll follow it. And thank you, Jeff. And we'll talk more about the congressional race. The election now 6 weeks from tomorrow. Rufus Craig, the man who finished second in the 6th District 2 years ago, is back for another challenge, and we'll talk with him after this time out on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. In 6 weeks from tomorrow, we have an election. The U.S. Senate is the marquee election in Louisiana, and Mary Landrieu, the three-term incumbent, will be with us tomorrow. We're joined now by the gentleman who finished second in 2012 in the 6th Congressional District race, Rufus Craig, a Libertarian, who in 2012 against Bill Cassidy received 32,185 votes. How about that? 32,000 people voted for this man. And when it was a long shot, he was the only one lining up. Now he's got company, 13 people running. Are these front runners, people who are just salivating at an open seat?
I think so, Jim. It's been a great experience that I've had this time compared to the other times because it has been a contest between numerous candidates. The candidate forums have been a real thrill for me.
By the way, there'll be a Republican event this week with all the Republicans invited at one of the local libraries, and I was invited to moderate, and when I agreed to do it, I thought it was for all the candidates. But when I found out it was only the Republican candidates, I politely declined. That's not fair, Poole, is
it? Well, you know, the way this district's configured, Jim, the Republicans have set it up so that they know that there's a real substantial chance that a Republican's going to win the race. So why share the stage with anyone else?
Well, if we had a Libertarian debate, you'd be the only one on stage, wouldn't you?
Well, at the candidate forums, if you listen to my Republican friends, if you closed your eyes and wished really hard, they might be Libertarians.
Well, I doubt that any of them are in favor of legalization of marijuana, for example.
Well, they almost Libertarians, Jim.
Almost Libertarians. So there is a dividing line with you and the other candidates, and 32,185 people voted for you last time. You finished ahead of Richard Toragano, who got almost 31,000 votes. Bill Cassidy in that race received 243,000 votes and was reelected. But it's easy to run when the seat's open, but it's tough to run against an entrenched incumbent, as you did. And you had the moxie to do so, and you finished second last time. So based on what happened 2 years ago, I would think that maybe you should be the front runner, Rufus Craig.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But, you know, Jim, I firmly believe in the importance of opposition politics. If you have an incumbent that's running without opposition, then you have one party rule, and that's not democracy. Mm-hmm. The advantage that I have over some of my compatriots in this campaign is that I'm able to raise issues that they, for whatever reason, feel unsure of themselves or incapable of raising.
All right.
You know, the secure the border and repeal Obamacare seems to be the theme of this year's election. I wish that the problems that this nation face were so simple.
297-5633 for Rufus Holt Craig Jr., local lawyer and libertarian running for Congress again. He was in a debate at the press club last time and with Congressman Cassidy and Richard Toragano, and a question was asked about public funding for public broadcasting, and Congressman Cassidy said he wanted to do away with it. And what was your answer?
Well, if I were in public broadcasting, I think the writing is on the wall that other sources of funding will have to be made available. But when you put the funding for public broadcasting in perspective, if we end the war in Afghanistan a month early, we could fund public broadcasting at its current rate for 30 years. So it's a question of priorities. Congress seems to have plenty of money to invade other nations, but they seem to come up short when it comes to small projects.
But Cassidy said Big Bird's got to go as far as public funding. Would you support Big Bird?
I support Big Bird. I support, yeah. Jim, as I said then, I listen to public broadcasting. I think it's a fine radio station. Like I say, but the issue of public funding, clearly that's the tide is moving against public broadcasting being funded by the government, but that doesn't mean that contributors can't continue to fund this great organization.
All right, I think I follow you, but contributors, of course, do so now, but this station gets about 15% of its funding from the government, and I would imagine LPB is that much or more, so...
Maybe they could call the Koch brothers.
So you're saying do away with public funding.
I'm saying that seems to be the inevitable.
But what we're talking about right now, not an inevitability 5, 10, 20 years from now. What about right now?
I think that the government spends too much money on everything
right now.
So
you say you're with Congressman Cassidy on this one. Okay. 297-5633, Bob on Highland. Bob, good morning. You're on with Rufus Craig.
Good morning. I'm not a libertarian, but I respect you as an honest candidate. You recall at the press club, 2012, you all asked where you got your funding from. You answered, the other candidate answered, Dr. Cassidy said he could not remember. You pointed out OpenSecrets.org had the information if anyone wanted to see it. The Baton Rouge Advocate never reported that.
All right. Is the source of your money when you're running for a public office, is that a legitimate issue?
I believe it is, Jim. I think that transparency in funding is something that we need. I think if a candidate's receiving substantial funds from particular special interests, that's something the public needs to know, who ultimately will be giving them their marching orders when they get to Congress. Transparency would be the issue. Would be the rule of the day. I think that the super PACs that have secret funding are a real problem in politics right now.
David Gordon, the station manager at WRKF, writes that only 10% of the current funding of WRKF comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And by the way, that money goes back and more to NPR for the shows that are heard on this station throughout the day and week. So it's not like the government is writing the biggest checks to keep this station on the air. But it is an issue, and it may resurface among your brethren and a few sisters that are in the race. Who do you view as your principal challenger in this competition?
The polls say that Edwards is going to make it to the runoff. I think that there are four Republicans that seem to be running in, at the head of the field, Mr. Clater, Mr. Graves, Ms. Whitney, and Mr. Dietzel, correct.
Yeah, and some of them have been running for a long time and have resources you don't have, so you would acknowledge this is a tough race for you.
Well, I say, as I said earlier, Jim, I'm in it to present opposition politics. Like I say, I'm in the fortunate position that I can take stances that they are unable to take because of their desire to win. You know, I've said publicly that we need to pull our soldiers out of all the foreign bases that we have all over the world, bring them home. I've said publicly that we need to end the war on drugs, stop the militarization of the police force, and let all the nonviolent people out of prison. Great way to save money. I've also said publicly that I wish that fixing the long-term debt and deficit problems in this country was so easy as repealing Obamacare, but I hear no meaningful conversation coming out of either party on how to deal with the $75 trillion in unfunded mandates that currently contain in Medicare.
All right. I've asked other candidates, and Sharon asked me to pose it to you, your stance on the fairness ordinance that was defeated by the Metro Council.
I don't think you should discriminate against anybody for any purpose. The Fairness Ordinance, as I appreciate it, tries to create a litigious right to prove that you've been discriminated against based on one of the classifications they have in it. I'm not sure that, particularly with reference to an individual's sexuality, that that's a relevant question unless your intention is to have sex with them. Other than that, I'm not sure what the what purpose that has in a conversation.
297-5633, but we live in a religious community, and some people believe, as Tony Perkins does, that this ordinance, as he puts it, amounts to a homosexual affirmation ordinance.
I'm not sure that it does that. Once again, Jim, as a libertarian, I believe that everyone has an absolute right to do whatever they want to with their person and property as long as they don't harm another person or their property. Mm-hmm. It's not my business to tell someone else what to do or how to live their life. I appreciate that Mr. Perkins is interested in saving the sinners of the world. However, I'm not, you know, that's not a function of government.
All right, 297-5633 for Rufus H. Craig, Jr., candidate for the 6th District. He received over 32,000 votes 2 years ago when he challenged the incumbent, the popular congressman from the 6th District, Bill Cassidy. Have you decided who you're voting for in the Senate race?
Not yet. Well, yes, I have. Brandon McMorris is going to get my vote.
You've got a Libertarian in that race?
Yes, there's right? A Libertarian on the ballot.
Okay. Well, Mary Landrieu will be here tomorrow, and I'm sure she will be trying to get your vote. Rufus, you're originally from?
Alexandria.
Well,
New Orleans, and I moved to Alexandria when I was 5.
And you went to school where?
Bolton High School, and then came to LSU in 1971 and been here ever since.
So you got your undergraduate and your law degree?
My law degree is from Southern University.
From Southern University, yes, sir. And your undergraduate from Louisiana State University. Well, one of the top candidates in this field does not have a college degree despite going to 3 universities. Is that an issue?
It may be for some people. Mr. Graves is a very eloquent man. He talks very well. He has a lot of experience in government, and clearly the money people are behind Mr. Graves for whatever reason that may be. I've never, Jim, been able to get my mind around the fact that you need $1.5 million to get a job that pays $160,000 a year.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Rufus Craig.
Morning. Do you think that the funding problem with politics could be altered if simply the Supreme Court went from 5-4 right-wing to 5-4 progressive and got rid of the Citizens United decision?
Well, Dan, I tend to agree with what you're saying, but I'm not sure that we're ever going to be in a situation where we can take money out of politics. As I said earlier, I think the key would be transparency in the contributions. As long as the voters know that, you know, if Mr. Smith has given a particular candidate $1 million, then we all know who the candidate works for. He's going to work for Mr. Smith. So transparency, I think, would go a long way in resolving some of the issues that we currently have.
Bob and Walker. Bob, good morning. You're on with Rufus Craig.
Let me ask you a question. It doesn't pertain to your subject right now. May I ask the question anyway?
Well, depends on what the question is. If it's okay. Not.
I thought, clear this up for me. I thought when Governor Edwards was sentenced that he couldn't hold another public office. Is there any truth to that?
Obviously not. He's done his time, served his probation, and
correct.
Once that is done, his rights as a federal candidate are restored. Now, there is a state law that apparently would preclude him from running for governor or whatever else, but he can run for a federal office.
You know, when Governor Edwards was governor, he helped the legislature pass a bill in Louisiana that gives first offenders a pardon, which is essentially the same thing as the federal statute. If you're convicted in Louisiana and complete your sentence successfully, you receive a first offender pardon, which restores your right to vote, to own mm-hmm. property, to run for political parties, that sort of stuff.
This district has changed dramatically since Richard Baker held it for 22 years. Baker won as a Republican over and over. Sometimes close races, though, with a district that was about one-third African-American. Now it's about one-fifth, and places like Iowa Street near the LSU campus are in Cedric Richmond's district out of New Orleans. Southern University's in Cedric Richmond's district. The airport's in Cedric Richmond's district. How could the Justice Department have signed off on something like this?
You've got me. It's if you look at the map, Jim, I'm not sure that it coalesces or corresponds to any political, geographic, cultural district that I'm aware of. It appears that it was drawn solely to accommodate the 2nd District and 6th District, I think, are their idea of a compromise. We get one that's slam dunk, and you get one that's slam dunk, Republican or Democrat.
Well, the slam dunk was almost there anyway. It took a real unusual situation for Joseph Gow to beat Bill Jefferson, who was in trouble.
Right. And Margie McKithen ran a pretty good race.
She did. That was 1998, though. That's been 16 years. And just from a geographic point of view, Congressman Cassidy lives at 3115 Dalrymple. And
he could probably throw a rock into the 2nd District.
He could throw a rock into the 2nd District.
Yeah. Well, the Voting Rights Act established that there should be a minority district, Jim, and I think that that perhaps it's been interpreted to say we'll give the minorities their one district and we'll keep the other five to ourselves. A buddy of mine likens it to America's apartheid, that we've created these small nation states within our states that belong to the minorities, and they can do business there. And in the rest of the state, the politicians really don't have to do it, don't have to even worry about the minority vote, because it's been so diluted by the construction of the various congressional districts.
Question from Rob asking, what will you do as a congressman, Rufus Craig, to curb coastal erosion in the state?
I would try to get funding for it.
Funding from whom?
From the federal government.
Okay, so in this case, you want the feds to pay up. What about funding from the oil companies?
I believe that the litigation is currently pending is good. Once again, as a libertarian, we believe that if you cause harm to someone else or their property, you have to repair it and pay for it. Mm-hmm. For years and years and years, the oil companies have basically had an amnesty or a buy on the damage they've caused. And I don't think it's ever too late to go back and say, hey, pony up your fair mm-hmm. share.
And on the gun issue, you believe in gun rights, don't you?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
And anything that you think could be done that's not being done to stop the carnage that we're seeing on our streets?
Sure, there's something that could be done. We could stop the war on drugs. and that would take that would eliminate a lot of the problems we have on the street. A lot of the violence is caused by the gangsters fighting over the money generated by the trade in illegal drugs. A lot of the violence is caused by the police responding to the violence mm-hmm. caused by the trade in illegal drugs. So ending the war on drugs would go a long way toward eliminating a lot of the violence that we have on our street.
Well, in other parts of the country, immigration's a big issue.
Well, you know, I've heard, like I say, my Republican opponents in this race talk about securing the border, and they're against amnesty. Jim, we've had a de facto amnesty against him prosecuting employers in this country for as long as I can remember. If you really want to, the people are coming here to get jobs. If you want to stop them from coming here to get jobs, you have to create an environment in which Americans won't give them jobs. If you're a contractor and you hire an illegal, you don't have to pay workers' comp insurance, you don't have to withhold taxes, you don't have to pay prevailing wages. And how can a person who complies with the law compete with that?
Well, Rufus Craig, he's in the hunt. 6 weeks from today, or tomorrow, is the election, Tuesday, November the 4th, and Rufus H. Craig Jr. will be on the ballot once again. Last time he got 32,000 votes. This time he gets 32,000, he might be in a runoff.
Absolutely.
Well, we are glad to spend time with you. And remember, tomorrow, if things go according to plan, in studio will be Senator Mary Loretta Landrieu. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.